Gather round, loyal listeners. It's the Brooking Report on Radio 1, 91 FM.
It is indeed the Brooking Report here on 91 FM. Good morning, Rachel. How are we?
That's about it. I'm very well, thank you. Very happy to be in Dunedin.
Yes, you would have been pretty busy. You've been busy, Bea. You were telling me just before off air, you've been doing Parliament till midnight because of the urgency legislation sittings.
That's right. This government's decided to put a whole lot of legislation that wasn't very urgent into urgency, which means we sit till midnight on the second day and the third day and the fourth day, if it gets that long. And then we also, of course, it means then that select committees can't sit unless they sit outside Parliament's hours. So we start those at 8 a.m. And then in the lunch break, 1 to 2.
That's nuts, mate. When you're in Wellington, are you sleeping somewhere that's near Parliament so the walk isn't too crazy?
I have a very short walk.
Okay, that's good. That's good. My partner's just found a place near Parliament in Wellington, so I'm looking forward to seeing that place. Now, let's talk about politics. We've got some pretty big developments happening internationally with the election of Zoran Mamdani over in New York. In an interview called 30 on 30 with Guy and Espina, Chris Hipkins, the Labour Party leader, said that he identifies with the term democratic socialist, because that's what Zoran Mamdani calls himself. And it seems like the sort of cultural tide is going a little bit more left. Is the same true for you? Do you identify with the term democratic socialist?
Well, I normally say social democrat, and I'm not a student of politics, so I'm not sure if there's a big difference or not, but certainly when we travel into Europe doing cross-parliamentary work, I'd always describe myself as a social democrat as a term that they understand.
I think the term democratic socialist, social democrat, is probably interchangeable, and I think it really refers to what the sort of Nordic countries do, where, you know, they've got free healthcare, free education, free everything basically, but very high rates of taxation.
They do.
And that's something that you would align with.
We're definitely putting the community first.
Yes, not necessarily the high taxation or anything, but giving a lot of public goods, I think.
That's right, and thinking about how we've got to look after each other, and that's why, of course, Labor did all the work back in the day on the state housing, and we've seen that come through, and why education is always such a focus, and, of course, healthcare for everyone.
Speaking of public goods, let's talk about public harms. This government is banning the use of puberty blockers for young transgender people at a time when 1 in 1,000 Kiwis are homeless, according to the Salvation Army. We've lost 72,000 Kiwis to Australia and from the year to September. Our fire emergency services are falling apart from defunding. I don't know if you saw, but there was a fire truck that was about 5 minutes from a house, but the fire truck broke down and they couldn't get to the house. It was in North Island somewhere. Why is this culture war stuff being put out there when we're living through a brutal economy and people are sorely struggling? Surely banning puberty blockers doesn't improve the economy.
100%. I agree with you. Of course it doesn't. I hate culture wars very strongly because it stops people having good conversations. And we know, as you say, that puberty blockers have got nothing to do with the economy, which apparently this government is all focused on growth, growth, growth. But that's just simply not true when they are entering these cultural wars and taking away the rights of some of the most vulnerable people that we have in our community. It's shocking.
It is shocking. It seems like the cultural war is becoming more of a worldwide phenomenon. You know, I've seen it in the US since about 2016 with, you know, Trump versus Clinton, and it's since spiraled out from there completely. Do you think it's something that New Zealanders really resonate with at all?
Well, we certainly have our fair share of it and have done for some time. It's my hope that we can focus on the issues that really matter to people rather than getting into them. And we see... I spend a lot of time on environmental issues, and we've certainly seen this government demonise not only road cones, which might be a health and safety issue, but also cycle lanes. And everybody knows that if you can encourage active transport, so that's walking or cycling, that you get better health outcomes, and that improves the lives of everyone. But instead, instead, for some reason, they're woke, and then, therefore the government can dismiss them and get rid of them, which is just crazy.
Or it's the same thing with the school lunches, calling sushi woke. You know, it's like, that's so racist. Calling his food from another cuisine woke, that's nuts.
Well, you say another cuisine, but we live here in Otipote, and there are a lot of sushi
shops.
That's
very true. Yeah, exactly.
It's a very normal food source.
It is.
And it's actually, as a mother of some quite fussy children, it is a food that they will all eat.
Yeah, yeah. I rate sushi hard. It's good, it's good. But one thing that's kind of behind the power of the culture war is populism, and that has really been on the rise worldwide, and we see that with Trump, and we also see that with Zoran Mamdani, who's really engaged in populism in a much more lefty kind of way. Do you think that's a strategy that that Labour could use the next election to sort of win some votes?
I think we have to be careful with populism as well. As you say, if you're simplifying things down to culture wars and that there's one simple answer for everything, that leads to a less nuanced position and debate. Mm-hmm. So we're very focused on things that I hope will be popular in terms of good, well-paid jobs, secure housing, good, healthy, warm, dry homes, and, of course, great access to good healthcare. Those are things, you know, that should be popular but might not be populist.
Fair enough. Over the past few weeks, we've watched Te Pāti Māori kind of fall apart at the seams due to a lot of internal conflict. You've been in government when MPs sort of turn their backs on the party, for instance, Gaurav Sharma. Labour also had a mini civil war in like 2013 to 2014 with different party factions backing different leaders. Were you part of that? Were you in the Labour Party when that happened?
I was not actively involved with that, what you describe as a mini civil war. But certainly I was there when Gaurav Sharma did his thing, and when Mika Whaitere crossed the floor as well.
Yes.
Ended up being the Minister of Food Safety as a direct result of that.
Yes. What is it like when a party sort of goes through that really tumultuous time? I can imagine you have an idea of what they might be feeling.
Well, it was a lot of confusion, really, with Gaurav Sharma, because that was not expected. We were doing well. He was a new MP like me. He was a backbench MP who'd been elected in 2020. So most of that was about one individual rather than sort of a wider systems issue. So that was the overwhelming emotion or thing at the time was to be confused about what was he doing and why was everything all about him.
And the chaos that kind of ensues is pretty nuts, and the media attention, they swoop in like vultures.
Well, and
as is their responsibility.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It would never say otherwise. Of course, it's interesting when a backbench MP who's elected in a big wave of support for Labour and for Jacinda Ardern personally then goes and says that somehow he's more important than all of that.
Yeah, it's pretty shiesty. But I mean, also in the last Chris Hipkins government, there was all sorts of, you know, mini cabinet scandals. There was Michael Wood's investment shares. I think there was a police minister scandal. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a scary time, and I imagine you can see what Te Pāti Māori are going through, and I can't feel good for them.
No, of course it can't feel good for them at all, and I, you know, hope for their sakes that they are able to work it all out and to be the politicians that I'm sure they all want to be.
Yes, and we'll see if that means that you guys become a government in the future. We'll have to see. But speaking of your most likely coalition partners, the Greens, they are pledging to revoke consents to a few mining companies if they are granted, should the Greens enter government at the next election in 2026. With all these new fast-tracking processes, there's been a few mining companies that have been afforded these consents. And Chris Hipkins says that Labour would honour these consents should you guys get into a government. If Labour aren't going to revoke these consents and Greens want to revoke these consents, how do we honour them, these commitments, whilst increasing scrutiny and environmental protections in these mining extractive operations, which were implemented under a more relaxed regulatory scheme?
Yeah. So the Fast Track Approvals Act, as it is now, has a purpose section that says to facilitate projects. And it doesn't say to facilitate projects in accordance with sustainable management. And because of that and the architecture of that act, it means that environmental protections are not at the forefront, which is a real problem.
Yep.
So we would fix that. that would be the first thing that we'd do is to fix how that act works immediately. And we've been saying that for the whole time that the fast track, this government's fast track has been around. Doesn't mean that we're opposed to a fast track. Labor had two different versions of a fast track act, one for COVID times and another when we did our repeal of the Resource Management Act and introduced two new acts, a Spatial Planning Act and a Natural and Built Environments Act.
Yeah.
And all of that is a complicated way of saying, you know, that, this issue is quite nuanced because the government will say, oh, well, Labor doesn't see the need for a fast track. And it's like, no, we had fast tracks. We just don't like your version of it because you were deciding to override environmental protections. That is the problem with this legislation. So then the other issues are, of course, that it's a dynamic issue, system at the moment of how many consents are going through these fast tracks and how many by the time of the election will have been approved or will not have been approved. We don't know that.
Yeah, we'll have to see what happens.
That's right. And the panels that decide these fast track projects have been doing a much better job than I thought they could have given the legislation that they're working under. And now, because of that good job, the government is looking at a very rushed process to amend the Act to further undermine the environmental protections. And they're calling it rats and mice changes and that it's all about supermarkets. It's not all about supermarkets. It is all about stopping the panels from doing environmental protections, which is terrible. So the issues of if you say we're just going to undo all the consents that are given under this piece of legislation that has passed through our parliament with a great deal of opposition from us, but it has passed, then that really undermines government's decisions and also puts us at risk internationally with international agreements to be liable to pay some of those companies compensation if we were to take away their permits.
Right. Sort of like what happened with the IRX ferry fiasco. We had to pay out Honda quite a lot of money, or Hyundai.
Yeah, well, that was a contractual issue rather than a parliamentary passing laws issue. But exactly, this is what this government's done. And, of course, it is up to governments to be able to have a sensible conversation about, well, if this consent, if this project is going to do so much damage to our environment, then it's worth us overturning it. That's a conversation that can be had later on. And I know the Greens are saying, well, we're putting companies on notice now that they shouldn't be applying for it. And so, you know, what I say to companies now is, do not try and get around the environmental protections. If any review was done, and our policy's not all set on this, it would be case by case, and reviews would be focused on things like very significant adverse environmental effects. So policy's still to come, but certainly the settings and the framework that we've taken to fast track this whole time has been about the absence of environmental protections, and we'd want better. We want good environmental protections, and we also want engagement with community that includes mana whenua.
Of course. And not even environmental protections aside, I don't know if you recently saw the Pike River mine film, but in that film they sort of tease out that a big reason of why that mine collapsed and why the tragedy happened, 15 years ago, was because it was a rush job. It was a complete rush job. And there were very few worker safety measures in place. I think if you're going to build something real fast without just slowing down, you can endanger the environment and the people who are making you money.
Absolutely. There is a place for fast tracks which can get you out of a system that is too slow, which is why we repealed the Resource Management Act, but this government brought it back. But it needs to still be robust. And as soon as you take away the robustness of a process, then one, you leave yourself open to judicial reviews, which can then slow down the process. So that's actions taken in court because you haven't considered everything.
Yeah.
Secondly, it can lead to these environmental problems. And you're quite right. Of course, it can lead to health and safety issues as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on to talking about climate change, because New Zealand was recently awarded Fossil of the Day once more at COP30 for lagging on climate action for many reasons, whether that's kowtowing to extractive lobbies, or the recent raft of climate reforms that sees legislated methane targets weakened and scrapping an election pledge to price agricultural pollution. Now that we know that agricultural, fishing and forestry account for 61% of our climate emissions, agri-banks tend to lend more to sustainable farming practices. So I really don't see what the benefit is to these changes. It seems like the industry is gearing towards reducing emissions. There's all sorts of scientific research on making cows fart less, to put it nicely. Why? What are the benefits to these changes that the government's doing? Is it to satiate federated farmers?
These are very good questions you have, Zach. It's just so depressing that this government says, on the one hand, oh, we're going to do emissions reductions that are really based on the ETS, the emissions trading scheme, market mechanism, but then they totally gut that market mechanism. So they say, oh, we're going to do carbon capture, and then they realise and everybody tells them, no, that's not going to work either. And so it's like, okay, more offsetting of pine trees, which are causing all sorts of problems. And the farming sector agrees that they are causing some problems. Like, not all pine trees are bad. I'm not saying that at all about forestry. But it's like everything, it's right tree, right place.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of upset amongst farmers about forests going in and taking away rural community. So I think there's just a whole lot of magical thinking going on. And in terms of the methane, so that is what we have from our animals, particularly cows in New Zealand, but also sheep, is Labor invested heavily in working with the agricultural sector to work on technological solutions. So there's different feed that animals can have, and there's a range of different factors, and people are looking at those, and they may well reduce methane emissions over time, and some of them are already working and are reducing methane emissions. But then why it is that you want to reduce the methane target in our carbon zero legislation is incomprehensible, because You have the government and you have the minister, and I've sat in select committees with him going through all of the different technologies that are in train to reduce methane emissions, and then next minute they're amending the target to lower the target for methane reduction. Why would you do that if you're so confident that we can get these new technologies on board to reduce emissions? And the what they called an independent review of the methane target said that, I mean, it basically said, oh, well, we're going to go above 1.5 degrees warming anyway, so let's change the target. Again, not sure of the logic there. And said it should go from 13 to 24. The target in the Act already includes 24 as the bottom number rather than the top number. So there's, even if you're being less ambitious, there is no reason to change the legislation.
Yeah, there's some going on there. It could be the tail wagging the dog with the NZ Act. It could be industry capture.
Well, we keep seeing that disgruntled groups text ministers and then happen. And we've seen that in freshwater.
Yep.
Over and over, a whole lot of last-minute changes. And going back to your speed point earlier, it's just there's no proper analysis of what the consequences will be. And then when I ask ministers, okay, well, you're going to make this change to laws, how are you going to monitor it? It does what you say and it doesn't do the terrible thing that I predict. And there's never an answer.
No, there's not. Are you familiar with Martin Bradbury?
I am.
Yes. He called this government the best government that money can buy, which is a great term.
Well, it's really gross. And that's been a big problem with the Fast Track Approvals Act as well, that 149 different projects were named in the schedule to the legislation. And so we argued, get a benefit from that legislation that can ignore environmental protections and can be for prohibited activities. So there's no other avenue for a project to get consent apart from being on this list. So we argued that that was a private benefit and not suitable for public legislation. If government wants to do something for the private interests of a company or a person, then it can do a private bill which is different from a government bill.
So many different ways to do things. Speaking of bills, the government has passed more legislation in a parliamentary urgency in its first 100 days than any other government. Last week, as you mentioned before, they pushed through 13 bills through urgency, some that weren't particularly urgent at all. This reduces debate, scrutiny, and consideration of the implications of proposed laws. Does urgency need reform so it won't be abused in the future like it is now? Because there's no telling. The government who comes after them could use it even more.
Yes, yes, I think it does. And Labor's submitted to the Standing Orders Committee around this issue. So it's important to think to know that there are different types of urgency. So sometimes urgency is called, and it's really just a way to make people sit till midnight and to sit through the morning sessions as well and skip select committees. But there are also all stages urgency, and this is where a bill is introduced and it doesn't go to select committee. We go straight on to the second reading, straight on to committee stage, and then the third reading, and the bill passes.
Yeah.
So a great example of this was the pay equity legislation. So we were in our caucus in the morning. The minister, Brooke Van Volden, made an announcement at 11 o'clock that something was coming. After question time, she stood up and started speaking. At that time, the House clerks came into the room, into the House of Parliament, and put the bill on the table. That was the first time we'd seen it, and it was passed by the next day. And she could not answer the questions about how people, different groups of workers, would be affected by this. She couldn't answer them all. She wouldn't answer them. And at the same time, you had David Seymour saying that she had saved the budget, and then the Prime Minister saying that it had nothing to do with the budget. So it was completely incoherent what they were doing. There was no robust debate. It was very difficult for us to work out what the bill was doing when you're just talking to it immediately. So that's an all-stages urgency process, and it is a terrible way to make law. Sometimes you might need to do it if there was actually...
if there's a crisis or something, you know.
Absolutely. And COVID, then what you can do is you can put in a post-enactment review clause and you can make them strong. And I saw Dr. Dean Knight, who's a lecturer at Victoria University, was making exactly that point the other day to the Standing Orders Select Committee. So if you need to do something, and there was a space one recently this year that Judith Collins put through, we supported the legislation, but we did ask for a post-enactment review clause, and she didn't agree to it, which was disappointing.
Well, hopefully in the future we'll have a government who actually embraces debate and respects process when you know your decisions impact everyone in New Zealand.
That's right.
You've got to be
government.
Held to account. Exactly, exactly. Thank you for coming on, Rachel.
Do
Thanks
you
have so any final words you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I'm assuming that most people have done with their exams, so any postgrads listening, go well over summer doing all the research and writing that you've got to do. And everyone else, I know it's a tight job market at the moment, but good luck for having a great holiday, and don't break your, don't sprain your ankle like Zach has.
Amen to that, amen. Thank you very much, Rachel. Thank you.
That was a Radio 191 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.